This is August the 24th, 1993, for the National Council of Jewish Women. We are interviewing Gerald Soroker in his apartment at the name of this house?
The Atrium.
At the Atrium near Fifth Avenue, Pittsburgh. This is Howard Braun and Selma Weiss. Say a word, will you?
Okay.
Yes. Jerry, last week we got out of Cleveland safely and to Pittsburgh just about. Is there anything in that transition you want to finish telling us about?
I'll just finish up on Cleveland very... finish up on Cleveland... little interesting point in Cleveland at the time, as in, you know, in any federation, there are strong leaders, and the social work group, about 10 or 15 of us from all the agencies and the federation, including the executive director of the federation, organized something called SWIG, Social Workers Investment Group. And with the encouragement, I've never seen this before, of our executive, we went to a couple of the people who are our laymen in the community and asked for ideas for investments. One of the people we went to, his name I'll mention because he's a well-known political figure today, is Howard Metzenbaum, who's a senator, state senator from Ohio. And Howard Metzenbaum, who was voted the most likely to succeed in his law class, was a dyed-in-the-wool liberal from the very beginning of his career and never stopped being a liberal, as you probably know. And he organized something that called Airport Parking of America, which developed into Avis. And he sold us at a nominal price a piece of an airport before it went public to this group. And then they went public, and it was really worth an awful lot of money. So I was going to say that he and another guy, another fellow, Bobby Brooks, doesn't make any difference what his name is.
It is.
Maury Saltzman, S-A-L-T-Z-M-A-N, very well known in the clothing business called Bobby Brooks, did the same thing. He gave us some, sold us some stock before they went public. So this is a very in the many places I've been, this is the only place where I dealt with laymen on a personal basis in terms of investment. But I must say that I was able to leave Cleveland with a few dollars, which permitted me to buy a house when I got here. It was very unusual and very lovely of their part, obviously. But, okay. That'll finish it.
It's important that you told us that story.
Oh, really?
Yes, it is. We need to know more of the world as it works.
Good. I'll give you a lot of that.
Yes, because otherwise your story's routine.
That's right.
And it is not routine to the extent that you do what you just did with that and whatever else comes to mind.
Okay. Okay. All right. Now we're in... We're in Pittsburgh. Let me preface.
Mm-hmm.
All of the discussions we've had today to tell you about one thing. I'm a social worker. I've been a social worker, trained as a social worker, got into administration. And there was never been a day in the 50-odd years, or how many years I was in the business, that I didn't enjoy going to work every day. And contrary to what many people would say, you know, working with laymen, they're the boss. They represent, in this community, 50,000 people, in a sense. It's a voluntary organization. Uh, I have found in all my career that these people have been wonderful to deal with. The leadership, the volunteers, the board people, the contributors, have made my life a very happy one through all these years. I've made many friendships on a personal basis, which I cherish to this day. So that's, sine qua non. That's been my approach and my inheritance or whatever I did in my job, which made it wonderful. Okay. There are a lot of federation, in a sense, in Pittsburgh, over the years, probably run by 20 to 30 people. Wonderful people, volunteers. And the kind of people that in an emergency, and we've had several in Pittsburgh over the years, in terms of the Jewish community, in an emergency, you could always get these 20 people to a meeting within half a day. No matter what they were doing, you could always count on these people being there. Again, that made my job much easier. Now, when I first came to Pittsburgh, one thing that you have to understand about federations, and they probably do, but the laymans have some problems with it. We're a fundraising, planning, budgeting organization, but basically, we don't get anything done unless we raise money. So obviously, a lot of the people that rise positions of prominence in the operation of the Federation are relatively large contributors. Some people have difficulty. Many people have difficulty with it. Because the truth of the matter is that 80 to 85% of the dollars raised come from about 4% of the people. So that those people that want a more democratic organization, one vote, one person, and there are people like that, don't quite understand that without these people there's nothing. There are about 1,000 people, maybe more now, in Pittsburgh that give $1,000 or more to the Federation. 1,000 people out of some 50,000. And that accounts for 80% of the money. Not that we don't work hard to get the rest of the dollars, but without those dollars, we don't have anything. So that's the name of the game. Now I had a few things happen to me because of that.
I want to interrupt you for a minute.
Anytime.
You said there's about 1,000 people who give
$1,000 over. I hadn't been here too long when some of the laymen in this 20-yard, some of the leadership, thought it would be important that I became a member of two of the clubs in town, Concordia and Westmoreland. And they didn't give me free membership, but they made it a little easier for me financially to join, because the initiation fees were difficult. And once that was done, I paid my regular fee. Lo and behold, when the thing was under process, two people came to see me. I will not mention their names. They're well-known in the community today. And so I should not do that. That it was wrong for me to take these favors from the wealthy people, that therefore I might be then prejudiced to make whatever decisions, even though I was not a decision maker per se, but as an executive you're in that position. And they said all terrible things would happen to me and so forth and so on if I did that. And nevertheless, I did. Not too long thereafter, there were rumors about some group having meetings, quiet meetings, to form their own federation. And I heard about it, my leadership heard about it, and we arranged a meeting. I can mention it, the president of the federation at that time was Alvin Rogow, and somebody else that was very active was Florence Reisenstein, who had a very unfortunate death through carbon monoxide poisoning in their car. Very right.
Florence Reisenstein, for whom the school is named.
Right.
Yes, Reisenstein Middle School.
Yeah, right.
I'm just adding.
That's okay. Okay, but it's right, it's true. Very well regarded person. So, Reisenstein and Rogal, myself, arranged a meeting with a couple of people that we heard were in the process of forming, trying to form this group. And as soon as Florence Reisenstein realized that really what they were trying to do was that they were really looking for a way to control the policy-making arm of the Federation, and yet at the same time making sure they could get the money that the Federation raised, well, the two were incompatible. And finally, I guess they found out that no matter how they thrashed around, there was no way they were going to get to control the money that was coming into the federations. So that thing disappeared. And there were a couple of people who were prominent who never did get anywhere in the federation in terms of leadership, because the decision of the leadership was that they were so difficult, they were better outside the federation than inside. They could make all the noise they wanted outside, but inside. So that's one of the things that happened in this federation. But I say these 20 to 30 people were so strong, so committed, and so bright, and so generous, that they kept this community on an even keel, and to this day, most of them would be here in within an hour if you had an emergency. Okay.
What you just told is a most commonplace event that I could imagine. Everywhere there are factions who want to control policy,
right,
without being responsible for the collection of the funds.
Right. I'm sure that's true.
Yes.
And they really went at it. But
really went at it.
Right.
I'd love to hear then a couple of names.
I bet I would.
I wouldn't do that. That's why. I don't know why.
I just couldn't do that to these people, even though they're not friends of mine. Say hello.
I don't see that this is an unusual event or there's no moral turpitude involved.
Very few people know about it.
I know that, of course, but that's the point. It's a commonplace event,
right,
in politics and right. Business.
Okay.
You know, tell us.
Now, during the my regime, there was another incident that took a lot of the leadership time. That was Bonnefield Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
You want to know a little bit about that?
Yes, we do.
And one of you in the hospital, place where most of the Jewish, Jewish doctors in town were members. And where...
What year are you talking about?
It probably is about 15 years ago. And most of the board wanted to develop closer relationships with the University of Pittsburgh and Presbyterian Hospital and become a teaching hospital, which was an important consideration. And they did become a teaching hospital. They made an approach to become a teaching hospital. But a group of doctors, many of the doctors at Montefiore, began to see that in this approach to being a teaching hospital, they were losing their prestige in terms of chiefs of staff, so forth and so on. And they felt that Presby was beginning to, in a sense, take over. And so bitter battles began to rage. And since Montefiore was a beneficiary of the Federation, we were giving him about $250,000 a year.
Which was nothing, but go ahead.
Yeah, relatively. But still over. The doctors came at us that we should do something about it, that we should not permit this to happen, and so forth. And there were bitter, bitter discussions. It really tore this community apart for a while. Finally, many of the doctors left Montefiore and went to the one downtown, Central Medical Pavilion, which was just being organized at the time. Eventually, most of them came back to Montefiore. And Montefiore was still a beneficiary of the Federation, still an independent hospital, but more or less the teaching program and so forth, their interns, how they got their interns and so forth, more and more began to get under the control of Presby and the University of Pittsburgh. And I guess the latest part of that was a few years ago by that time, most of the doctors that had been involved in being against it were already retired or semi-retired and had given up that particular fight. Many of them moved, and as a last resort, many of them moved to West Penn. About 2 years ago, I noted the names of several chiefs of staff at Montefiore prior to or during this move to sell it to Pitt. Left and went to West Penn. So that it no longer was a Jewish hospital in that sense. Now, I must add, and they sold the hospital, I think, for $300 million or something like that. Interestingly enough, and then he developed the foundation with that $300 million. And the idea of the foundation, which was incidentally, they have a Jewish board, and the board, president of the board is, the foundation board is Alvin Rogow. But I must say, and the idea was they would give money to the Jewish community, amongst other things. And I just heard that there's a fundraising campaign now to raise some $35 million for a new center, which will include a new, really be a campus, which will include the Jewish, some of the Jewish institutions, Jewish Family Children's Service, for Ages, administration, the center, Jewish education. And the Montefiore Foundation is giving $20 million of that $35 million. So that, in a sense, some good is coming out of that particular area. And just as an aside, I had a doctor's appointment. The name was familiar to me, but I wasn't sure whether the doctor's appointment, my wrist would bother me or something, several weeks ago. And I was upset because I had to wait too long, and I was complaining to the doctor, and he was agreeing, and then he began to tell me what he was. And he was writing the history of Montefiore. So I was having trouble getting funding. I offered that was always I offered it, if I could be of help. But he was writing his history. I guess one of the old timers who felt that, you know, it should never have been sold.
There's a question, as long as you're talking about Montefiore, of the various hospitals around Pittsburgh, all were burgeoning except Montefiore. Now, there was, because much of the, perhaps their clientele was a poor clientele, public funded, so on. Was that the reason? What other thing, and the Jewish need, the need of Jewish doctors had gone away, but is there anything more you can say about that?
The basic problem, two couple of problems. The basic problem was that Jewish doctors no longer needed the Jewish hospital. Mm-hmm. That was the basis. So many of them were going to other hospitals. So the rationale, secondly, the matter of funding. We'll give him $250,000, which is a drop in the bucket. And well,
That was a token just to keep our name in.
Right.
Yeah.
And the net result was that as all the hospitals began to get fewer and fewer patients, and Montefiore, I think, at the very last point, was only, maybe only 20% of the Jews went to Montefiore. Smaller and smaller numbers, and it didn't fill up the hospital, so the struggle for the dollar got more and more difficult. And they didn't have enormous foundation, and for one other reason, and that probably was one of the major problems I see, they never had a lot of endowment money. Somehow the Jewish community didn't leave them the kind of money that the Mellons and the Carnegies and so forth left to the other hospitals in this area. And that made a big, it was like...
Allegheny General didn't have all that. Neither did that West Penn, even though Shadyside did. So that's part of the answer.
Well, there was a lot of it.
Because
I've noticed even at Allegheny, some of the old names that I see on the
they all have some, sure.
In any event, that was the it just got too much of a struggle. Now, there are some people say they could have made it, but there was a tremendous desire to be a teaching hospital, a matter of pride and prestige. And the price of being a teaching hospital was getting enveloped and being taken over by freshmen, which was really behind the University of Pittsburgh. So that's what happened to the hospital. In Pittsburgh, I just was not big enough in terms of the Jewish community to carry the weight.
Yeah.
Only 50,000 Jews or less. And as people grew older, the business of needing a Jewish hospital got less and less. The kids grew up, they were in a different era. They didn't see the need for it. Okay. Some of the other interesting things that happened. One of the big problems that always in any federation is how you distribute the money. And those that want more money for Israel and those that want more money for local, and that goes on and on. And we were a pretty independent federation, made our own decisions. All federations were independent. Some were more tuned into overseas, some less. We were pretty independent in that part of it. And I thought made some good decisions. And and I'm leading up to this community's attitude towards Israel. If you want to talk a little bit
about
that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. In the early years, there were problems in Pittsburgh. And there was a vocal group that, if not positive, if not against Israel, were neutral vis-a-vis Israel. Unfortunately, one of those places was Rhoda Phillips. And a whole generation of people grew up at Rhoda Phillips that were non-contributors, very modest contributors. And the rabbis, there was a league of about two rabbis, three rabbis. You know, Rhoda Phillips tried very hard in the initial years. They didn't have bar mitzvahs or bar mitzvahs, and they tried very hard to copy the attitude of Americans to their religion. And there was another place in Chicago that did the same thing. And so the net result was that there was this group, and that was that made it that made the fundraising difficult in the early years. The community struggled during that period. Now that's all overcome. We have a very positive attitude, and so forth. During what's leading me up to Israel is the Yom Kippur Wars and this community's response to the wars. And some amusing things happen during these things. During the Yom Kippur War, was that the first one? I mixed up. The Seven-Day War, the first one, or the Yom Kippur War
was the second
one. The Seven-Day War.
You're talking about the 67
war. The 67 war.
No,
the one where they invaded Egypt.
The one that was successful with the Six-Day War. That's called the Six-Day War.
Yeah,
right. The Six-Day War, not the
Six-Day War. And when that happened, we had people coming to the office, people we never saw before, handing us thousands of dollars in cash, and we never saw them again. Kind of a response. And you had people calling up our leadership, these 20 or 30 people. Well, how much do you need, Jerry? Will 25,000 be enough? That was how they all reacted, these leaders, to these critical situations, and I always found that to be. And then that when they were
Jerry, who you said speaking to you?
Yes, as the executive. Well, what's needed? How much do we need? Is this enough? What are the other boys doing? Everybody follows the leader in terms of campaigning. And that was a very heartwarming experience for me and for the community generally. And some people would come in, give me a gun. And then during the Yom Kippur War, which is a much more difficult war, a little amusing story, I was in Spain with my wife on a vacation. And we were in a little old car, didn't have a radio. So the war's on, we don't even know it. I finally get to a town, and I see the newspaper, so I call up, and the president, Don Robinson, at the time, was hysterical. He says, I'm sitting at your desk, I'm going crazy. He says, where are you? I said, I'll be home within a day, or within an hour, or however, 8 hours. So we rushed to get reservations. We get to the, and I thought I had reservations, wife and I, we get to the airport, they got one reservation. I'm looking at Eleanor, and I look terrible. What am I going to do? I think, goodbye, Eleanor, I'll see you later. In any event, they took pity on us, they gave us the... But I remember when I got on that airplane, there was somebody from some Air Force General, United States Air Force General. He was pointing out what was happening to Israel because they had these SAM missiles that Syria had at the time. They were shooting down a lot of the Israeli planes. And I guess it took them a while before they found out how to overcome this scattering,
petty or whatever it is they do to offset that.
And then when I got back, the same happened. A couple of things did happen. And this is an experience. There was a doctor in town. There is a doctor in town named Stanley Hirsch. He got on the next airplane and went to Israel, went to the front lines up near Syria and operated. And he called his wife, the next nurse, I think, and told her to come on the next airplane and bring equipment. And he stayed there quite a while. It was quite a story. Very quiet, self-effacing kind of person. Wonderful guy. He had some kind of illness. And I don't think he's in surgery anymore, but he's a vascular business. But at any rate, that was, again, a very heartwarming experience. And then we had, during the shifting gears, I think.
You're shifting gears, that's
okay.
Okay.
Well, 4 minutes is a lot. No, you're right. I don't think.